week, 0 and week and 10, 0 and week and 10, 2, 0, 0, 0, 6, 2, 0, 0, 0, 6, 8, 2, 8, 6, 0.
Coloring book brand! Okay, this time I wanted you guys to hear the midget thing. I left it in because I wanted you guys to hear what I have to hear, or what I've, well, I don't really have to hear it. I kind of like hearing it now. Now I kind of like it. I don't know. I feel like maybe we just start every stream with midget. I don't know. Maybe. Anyway. Welcome to the Insomnia Stream, Animal Croy Edition. I'm your host, of course, Devin Stack, drinking coffee. Hope you're having a good weekend. Thank you, everyone, that checked out the other show, by the way, Outlaws, on Wednesday. Good feedback so far. There's always going to be haters. What are you going to do? And we'll be back on Wednesday. So that'll be fun. Honestly, I don't know what it's about yet. I'll find out, I think, tomorrow. Been working on this stream. Now I got two jobs. That's okay. Anyway. Yeah. So I guess... you know, actually, before we get started, I probably should have downloaded the clip. I wanted to talk about one thing. One thing. And actually, tonight's stream will kind of illustrate what it is that I want to talk about here a little bit, or rather reinforce my opinion on what it is I'm going to talk about here in a second. Let me see if I can download it real quick. Hang on. I'll play the audio, because you don't need to see this guy anyway. It's Yarvin. And in fact, even listening to Yarvin is a little bit tough, so we're not going to listen to the whole clip, because it's just so, it's really rough, guys. Listening to this guy talk is, and he's so punchable in so many different ways. And, I'm sure his lunch money got stolen a lot. But anyway, Curtis Yarvin, who, for whatever reason, and I honestly don't know. I honestly don't get it. For whatever reason, has the ear of a lot of rich and powerful people as some kind of, like, Jewish oracle. Almost as if he's trying to be, like, the Zionist rights Dugin or something like that. You know, he's just... But anyway, he's usually terrible. He's usually awful. But he was on some interview, I guess, the Peter McCormick show. Never heard of that either. The Peter McCormick show, talking about white genocide and talking about how that whites weren't going to really do much about it, and that we were going to experience the South Africanization of the West. And Elon Musk retweeted it with just the word yikes. Good job. Thanks for the help, billionaire white guy. So glad you're out there to help prevent white genocide by tweeting yikes. Yikes. Wow, thanks a lot there, Elon. Thanks for all the help. Wow, yeah. If you're actually worried about this, you know how little it would impact him? How little it would impact him to just throw, like, not even like lots of money, like a normal amount of money at maybe a couple NGO, like maybe make an NGO, make a pro-white NGO. Maybe just send super chats, for fuck's sake. Like have one of your guys go around watching all pro-white content and funding some of this stuff, right? Or I don't know, just something, for fuck's sake, other than yikes, a tweet that says yikes. That's your contribution to saving the white race is yikes. And then playing this clip. I mean, cause beyond retweeting stuff, Elon Musk really doesn't lift a finger to help white people. And he has infinite resources to do so. When you look at what he was giving his baby mamas, you know, like it was no big deal, then I'm sorry, you can afford to fund a couple NGOs and maybe a media company, maybe like a real media company, maybe like a real think tank, you know, maybe like a real organization that goes after budding young college students and tries to make them, you know, loop them into the pro-white way of viewing things by making them a fellow or something like that. You know, there's ways of cultivating young, powerful, promising white people. And instead, you hire Jeets and say, yikes. You say, yikes. But anyway, this is what Elon was yikesing at. This is what he, I'm like, again, I can't handle listening to this guy. Like, anytime I feel self-conscious about my voice, I just have to listen to some Curtis Yarvin, and I instantly feel like the smoothest operator that ever existed. But anyway, I'm going to fast forward through like most of what, because the first half of him is just, it's so bad. It's so bad, guys. I can't handle this guy just talking at all. Oh, and of course, I need to unhide. There we go. I had to hide some sources for the other show, and now, there we go. Now it's back to normal. That was the only, I thought I'd unfucked OBS for the show, and that's the only thing I forgot. All right, so this is, I think this is the right place. I don't know. Let me see where it's at.
Basically, the next time Democrats win the presidency.
See, and that's the other problem, too, with what he's saying. He's basically, he's framing this as if the Republicans are the saviors of the white race. If you guys don't vote for Republicans, then it's all over. You know, once the Democrats get into office, then it's white genocide. Like, yeah, really? Really? Because Republicans are doing so much to combat white replacement. Right. They're doing, we got all those mass deportations, right? We got all these mass deportations and we got none of that. We got fucking none of that. And we're not going to get any of that. And so don't give me the Democrats bullshit. And again, he's a Jew, so he's never going to be honest about this, but he's right about this one part.
People talk about like mass immigration, no, we have not seen mass immigration. We have no idea what mass immigration is. Mass immigration is not 2 million people entering the U.S. a year. Mass immigration starts, I would not call it mass until it was like 10 a year. And like mass immigration is really the 10 to 50 to 100 million a year.
But that's what could spark civil war.
No, no.
I don't know. I'm seeing it here.
No, because people have no balls.
By the way, that's overstated. 150 million a year, dude. Okay, so like half the population of America showing up. Give me a fucking break. First of all right, whatever. 30 million, I was like, yeah, it could be that at some point. But you can't. 150 million would just basically, I would almost want that because that would be instant war. That would be instant race war. If 150 million people tried to show up at once in 1 year, that would be instant race war. But anyway.
People have no balls. And actually, like, you know, they will not resist. They will not resist. All of, you know, the thought that they will get their muskets and put on their tri-cornered hats or whatever. You know, when you go back and you go back into the period when people actually did this, you're just like, fuck, these people are completely alien to us.
Well, first of all, they're completely alien to you, Yarvin, Curtis Yarvin, because you're not American. You're a Jew. They're alien to you because they're literally not you. That's like me going to Japan and opining about some of the problems of Japan and then saying, yeah, if you go back 300 years, yeah, these people are completely alien to me. Well, so are the people that live around you right now, Curtis Yarvin. I'm completely alien to you in the same way that you're completely alien to me. So fuck off trying to do this wee shit. But anyway.
Never happened. It won't happen at all. What will happen is exactly what happened in South Africa, which is they will just acknowledge that they've lost all of their power forever, and then they will sit quietly in their houses and build more and more barbed wire and electric fences until finally they are exterminated in one big pogrom. That's the future. That's what will happen to your children.
Which is funny that he used the word pogrom, because I think really that illustrates all these right-wing Jews that are suddenly worried about white replacement. If you want to know what motivates them, it's because they see themselves not as white, but they know that the brown people see them as white. It's self-preservation. It has nothing to do with wanting to preserve white people in so much as, unless that includes them, right? Like, that is their fear. There is a growing number of Jews who think that when the kill whitey war happens, they're going to be lumped up in that. And that's real. So he kind of betrays himself there. But that's in terms of people rising up and going after the bad guys. That's the reason why that won't happen is very few people are related to those people anymore, including white people. Very few of the white people in America are related to those people. So that's part one. That's part of why there is no genetic or even historical connection between the majority of America, vast majority of Americans, and those people, including Curtis Yarvin and including a lot of the white people. That's number one. Okay. Number two, in order for anything to get that bad, you have to have, or people get that motivated, you have to have leaders. You have to have leaders, and you have to have leaders with means. And people like Elon Musk, who have the ability to start planting these seeds in a much more effective way than retweeting a clip from Curtis Yarvin and saying, yikes. Elon Musk, who comes from South Africa and is likely part Jewish himself, or I don't know, there's something there. He has Jewish children, at the very least. But anyway, I just wanted to talk about that because he is right in a sense. He's right in a sense that, yeah, it's extremely difficult to get people to do anything more than just bitch on Twitter about something. And there's not even a lot of white people doing that, to be quite frank. I think that people overestimate the amount of white people even doing that. Because the siloed echo chambers that everyone's been put into. Unless something dramatically changes, you are looking at the Brazilification at best of the United States, and probably a lot of Europe, and the South Africanization of the United States at worst, and most likely at least parts of Europe. We'll see. I think Europe might actually stand a better chance. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Like, it's funny because, like, on one hand, I see Americans as just being generally more aggressive people. but at the same time, they're not doing anything. and the other side of it is Europeans, of course, they don't have they have a historical context that's much different, right? They don't have this Jew poison of nation of immigrants. Now, don't get me wrong. The Jews have been like trying to poison the well, trying to tell people that even European countries are nations of immigrants. But, you know, the first Britons were black and all this other stupid shit. But it doesn't sell. It doesn't sell as easily as it sells here. In fact, it sells really well here, which leads us into our show tonight. This is a little, I guess, a little story that it's an example of what to expect in the future because it already happened in the past. We're going to take you back. We're going to take you all the way back to the 70s. As I've mentioned before, the 70s, a decade when I think the gates of hell literally were opened. And you might agree once you see some of this stuff. 1978, July 14th, 1978. This is in Eureka, California, right here. This picture we're looking at. I think we're looking at it, right? Let me. Got too many windows open right now. Yes, we're looking at it. Okay. The number one movie at the time in July 14th, 1978 was Warren Beatty in Heaven Can Wait. The number one TV show was Laverne and Shirley. And the number one song at the time was this little number. Ah, yes, Shadow Dancing by Andy Gibb. For those of you old-timers who might remember that, or for those of you who are almost as old, you might remember that that same exact song was used by South Park in their first season. When Mr. Garrison got his rhinoplasty and looked like, I guess this is when, this was looks maxing, when Mr. Garrison started looks maxing in season one.
Hi, Mrs. Campbell.
Oh, howdy, Mr. Garrison. Say, honey, you look kind of different.
Really?
Did you get a haircut?
No, but thanks for asking.
Call me. I'm in the book.
Wow, Mr. Hat, having a nose job is even better than I thought. There's a whole world of opportunity opening up in front of us. I bet I could rustle up all kinds of poontang if I smashed myself in the face with a hammer.
Oh, yeah. All right. So that's the year, 1978. That's the music playing in the background. The movies playing in the theater. The show's on TV. And as I said, this is Eureka, California. Eureka, California. Small town in California. Out by, I think, Mount Shasta, right? So anyway, Patrick Hootie Croy. Hootie was his nickname. Patrick Hootie Croy was 23. He was a Native American. One of those, the sophisticated savages in the part of the Shasta Karak tribe. You know, noble and wise. He worked in a logging camp. And, as you do after working at a logging camp all week, you begin your weekend of drinking whiskey, beer, smoking marijuana, and hash. So he starts getting drunk immediately Friday night. And by Sunday evening, he is completely hammered. He's been drinking nonstop because Indians, that's what they do. For those of you who don't know, Indians, they drink. They just drink and drink and they drink and then they steal and then they drink and then they steal and they drink and drive and then they murder people and they steal and they drink. And it's pretty much what, I mean, if you want to know Indian behavior, check out the Whitmans, and it's actually not too far from where this was. So, say, more things change, the more they stay the same kind of a thing. So, good old Patrick Hootie Croy here was getting annihilated. And by Sunday evening, he was had 20 people over at the house making so much noise that the police were called. And that's a hell of a thing. If you get the other Indians, the other drunken Indians are calling the cops on you. If you've made that much of a racket, you know, then, you know, there's an issue. There's an issue. So the cops get called. And let's see. I just moved my notes. We'll get back to it. Here we go. I got my notes back. I know what happens next, but there's a sequence to the pictures. I need the notes to know what what picture shows up next. So anyway, the cops show up, and he's with his sister Norma Jean, who's also drunk. So it's Norma Jean, this guy, 20 other drunken Indians. The cops show up, and when the cops show up, he starts yelling that he's going to kill one of the cops. He tries to hit one of the cops. He's restrained by his drunken friends. And as the police leave, without arresting him, by the way, I mean, he's threatened to kill a cop. He's tried to take a swing at one of them. And the cops are just so used to just drunken Indian patrol that they're just, whatever, dude. We're going to, or just, you got to keep it down. Your neighbors are complaining. I'm going to kill you. All right, yeah, okay, you're going to kill me. And, you know, whatever. But then he says he's going to get his gun after the cops leave. He's serious. He's very upset. He actually goes to his house and goes and gets his rifle. They then drive downtown Montauk, California, which is right near Eureka, California, and pick up their friend's car. A bunch of these Indians drunk with guns riding around in a car in Montauk. What could go wrong? Then, of course, because they are a car full of drunken Indians with guns, they decide it would be a good idea to go to the liquor store. You know, they've been drinking since Friday night. It's now Sunday afternoon. They're driving around blasted with guns, but they don't have any bullets. And one of the reasons why they don't have any bullets is Croy was so hammered that even his wife, his drunken Indian wife, knew that he was too drunk to be carrying a gun around, so she took the bullets out of the gun before he got his gun. So they decided they had to go get bullets. Can't imagine what for. I mean, he had just recently threatened to shoot a cop and tried to punch a cop. I don't know. I don't know what he would want those bullets for. They go to a liquor store that sells bullets. We used to have nice things in America before people like this ruined it. This is California, by the way. This is in California. In California in the 1970s, you were still high trust enough to sell liquor and bullets at the same place. Because it was I've actually been in Utah. It's been some years now. I don't know if these still exist. In Utah, even. Now, they only sold Utah beer, for those of you who know what that is. I've been to a store that sold ammunition and beer. And I'm sure some of these still exist, but not in California. Not in California. So they go to a store that sells liquor and bullets. When he walks in, the clerk remembers him from going in there previously to buy liquor for their drunken weekend, because when the clerk gave him his change, he accidentally gave him too much. He gave him $2 extra. And when he realized it, he said, "Oh, hey, man, I just gave you $2 too much. Do you mind giving it back?" And he basically said, "Fuck you, Whitey," and left. And so when he came back, he's like, you're the fucking stinking engine that walked off with the $2 I gave you. And he gets mad and starts yelling at him and says, "I'm going to fucking kill you. And, you know, you just better listen to me. We're here to get bullets and alcohol." And then his sister, Norma Jean, starts going completely fucking apeshit, completely unhinged, and just starts screaming in this weird, you know, engine rage. And the clerk says, look, that bitch has got to go. She's got to go. And so she pulls out a knife. She pulls out a knife and holds it against his back and says, you're going to go into the cooler. We're going to walk you into the cooler. As she's walking him into the cooler, one of the Indians gets into his face and starts screaming, stab him, stab him, stab him. At this point, the clerk manages to get away, runs out of the liquor store, and starts looking for a cop. A nearby cop happens to see what's going on, sees the commotion, and starts to drive up to the liquor store as the Indians run out, get in their car, and drive off. At that point, the clerk goes back inside and sees that they have robbed the register and taken 4 boxes of bullets. The cops are quick to pursue the drunken Indians with now loaded guns. They start driving back to their shack. During the pursuit, they start shooting at the cop cars. So they're shooting at the cop cars, and the cops start radioing in. We're chasing a carload of drunken Indians, armed drunken Indians, who are shooting at us. And so more cops join in the pursuit. They then surround the shack, and some of the drunken Indians, run up over a hill that's behind the shack. One of them was the sister, Norma Jean, and then some other drunk Indians, and a couple other Indians scatter. There is some gunfire exchanged between the police and the drunken Indians. Eventually, one of the cops decides to go and try to apprehend one of the drunken Indians, and he is shot and killed. His name was Jesse Hitson. Jesse Bo Hitson. They call him Bo. He is shot in the heart and dies almost instantly. He's alive for like a couple minutes. He's allowed to respond, but he dies pretty much within minutes. At this point, you now have cop killing Indians who are drunk, high, armed, who just held up a liquor store and are hiding out, taking shots at cops who just, they just killed a cop. The cops keep firing into the building. They finally, after this goes on for quite some time, up to 30 cops show up. They finally shoot Hootie Croy. They finally shoot Hootie Croy, and the Indians give up. And they actually take him away to the hospital. They don't just let him bleed out. He just killed a cop. He just killed one of their friends. But they don't just let him bleed out, which is what I would have done. So about after they start searching their property, Croy's rifle is found under a stove behind the building, loaded with 3 bullets, the same type that were missing from the liquor store. So it was the stolen bullets. The single fingerprint on the gun was Croy's, and the rifle that killed the officer was that rifle. The forensic test showed that that was the gun that fired the fatal bullet. Croy was taken to court, and a jury found him guilty, along with his sister, But he was found guilty and given the death penalty. He was given the death penalty. So as we all know, stream over, right, guys? I mean, he got the death penalty, so he's probably dead now, right? Isn't that what happens when you get the death penalty in America? Right? Isn't that what happens? I mean, that's what used to happen before Jews showed up. And so what really happened was in the 1980s, his lawyers, to be fair, were not all Jewish. One was not yet. He gets the fancy Jew lawyer in a second here. But he still had public defenders. And the crazy thing is, they were able to get his conviction overturned, not because he didn't do it, not because there was anything really wrong with the process, except for one little technicality. One little fucking, this is what's wrong with our legal system. One little fucking technicality. And that technicality was basically the phrasing of the judge's jury instructions to the jury. It was just, he left out basically like a word. It boiled down to, like, literally, it boiled down to the fact that he didn't say that Croy had to intend to kill, like, for the specific charge that he had to intend to kill the guy that he shot and killed. Because the judge didn't say that to the jury in the jury instructions, that the guy that he shot and killed, in order to find him guilty, you had to believe that he intended to shoot and kill the guy that he shot and killed. They threw it out. They literally threw it out. They threw out the conviction. They threw out the death penalty. Jewish judges, obviously. Get ready for more of those, because it gets more fun from here on out. This is the boring part, believe it or not. This is the boring part. This is the part that, like, oh, of course, an Indian gets drunk and shoots a cop. Like, this is just, you know, this is what happens. You know, this is just what happens when you have non-whites in charge of the legal system that is supposed to be in place to, well, essentially police the non-whites that are going around killing whites. You know, what happens when the whole reason why we have cops, for the most part, is to basically keep the non-whites in check. Let's just be honest here. What happens when the legal system and the cops at this point are non-whites themselves? Well, again, this was decades ago. So in 1985, the Supreme Court affirms throws out the conviction, and he goes back to trial. And the new lawyer he gets, this is where he gets the fancy Jew lawyer, is this guy, this fucking demon-looking motherfucker. This is not AI. That's really what he looks like. That's actually what he looks like. And yes, obviously, we don't have to look, but so you know for sure, yes, he is a child of a Jewish immigrant from Eastern Europe that came here around the turn of the century. Obviously, because they always are, right? They always fucking are. So this is Tony Serra. Tony Serra, Jew lawyer, who, by the way, didn't just represent Hootie. In fact, I forgot to bring the picture up. Let me show you this other wonderful client of his. He was famous already at the time because he had defended... Let me pop this up here. This nice young man. That's right. This nice young man. Also a cop killer. Also a cop killer. His name was Huey P. Newton. Might have to do a stream on this. Might have to do a stream on this lawyer. Huey P. Newton killed a cop named John Frey. He is also one of the founders of the Black Panthers. So, this Jew, he's used to getting rid of, getting non-whites who kill whites out of jail. So he swoops in. And he's got an interesting, very interesting new defense. And it has to be interesting because the evidence shows clearly that Croy's guilty. You've got Croy's fingerprints on the gun. It's Croy's gun. You have the forensic evidence that shows that his gun shot it. You have the fact that you have witnesses. You have the fact that he was threatening to kill cops and that after the cops left, he got his gun and then killed a cop within hours of threatening to kill a cop. So, yeah, it's a pretty open and shut case. Jury instructions aside. So how is this goblin Jew going to free the non-white that kills white people? Because it's very important for goblin Jews to have non-whites that kill white people just running amok in our society. That's what they're here for. Yarvin can bitch and moan all day long about how it's going to be South Africa soon, but he sure as fuck never mentions the fact that it's because of people like him that that's what's going on. And it always has been. Fucks like him that have been creating the problem that he's now complaining about. All of a sudden, oh my God, the golem that we created is running amok and now it might hurt us. Well, fuck you. Fuck you. Especially after you get a load of this defense. So this is a document written by another Jew who thought that the defense of the goblin Jew is so fascinating and so genius that it could serve as a blueprint for any non-white that might kill a white. And she wrote up this document after working with the legal team for months and also shooting a documentary, which is not available anywhere. Oh my God, I wish I had that. I looked everywhere for this fucking documentary that went along with this document and I could not find it. But I bet it's just fucking pure gold, and you'll see why here in a second, because this was the accompanying document for that video, which does exist online, but just not the video. So this document goes over the legal strategy and explains it in no uncertain terms exactly what they plan to do to get a Indian who 100% killed a white guy off for murder. Let's have a little listen.
The Croy retrial and its application of the cultural defense.
So that's what it's called. It's called the cultural defense. Like the Twinkie defense, you've heard of that, right? This is the cultural defense.
It is not possible to cover 4 years of trial preparation and the 8-month trial in any kind of detail.
So there's the resources that were put into this. 4 years. Jews poured money because someone's paying for this guy and the rest of his legal team. This is the kind of stuff that they're funding that Elon's not funding. 4 years they prepped for this case.
Rather, this article will discuss some specific examples of the way in which the cultural defense was woven into each stage of the case, and then focus on a discussion of a model for the construction of any death penalty defense for a minority person in future cases.
See, it's going to be the model. This is going to be the model for any non-white that commits murder. Any non-white that kills a white, this is literally a template for a legal defense strategy for any non-white that kills a white person.
The starting point of the defense preparation consisted of the defense team, attorneys, investigators, and paralegals, developing a working knowledge of Patrick Croy's Indian background and the racial oppression he and his community had experienced in Siskiyou County.
Oh, my goodness. So they had to start by investigating the racial background. What kind of bigotry was going on in their community that they could basically then lean on during their defense?
That knowledge was gained through conversations with him, local Indian people, Indian experts, Indian leaders, and written material. This understanding led to the rejection of the inappropriate diminished capacity defense for the retrial.
See, the original defense was going to be, well, he was too drunk. He was too drunk to get the death penalty. He was so blitzed out of his mind, he didn't know what the fuck he was doing. So we can't give him the death penalty because he's an Indian.
Self-defense was the true defense and could prevail, particularly if augmented with a cultural explanation.
Oh, it was self-defense. Don't you understand? If you're an Indian, you go into town with your gun and then you hold up a store, steal bullets while your sister's getting stabby with the clerk, and then run from the cops and then shoot at the cops that are chasing you and then kill one of them once you get back home. It's self-defense. If you really understand the cultural context, and that is where they're going with this. If you really understand the big picture, if you understand the big picture and how Patrick Croy, how he fits into this picture, then you'll understand why it was actually self-defense killing this cop.
We felt confident that if the jury understood how both Mr. Croy's and the police officer's state of mind was imbued with the historic relations between Indians and whites, that is, that the police were playing out the role of the vigilantes of the last century, and likewise that Mr. Croy's actions that night were an outgrowth of the historic state of mind of his forefathers, which caused him to believe that, like them, he was about to be killed.
Oh, you see? See, in Patrick Croy's drug-addled mind, in his drunken engine brain, he thought what was happening was what happened to his ancestors, the white man, the settlers, as we all know. If you've watched my streams, you know that's all bullshit, but... Yeah, as Jews have been telling white people now at this point for decades, you know, the white people just came and wiped them all out indiscriminately. He was just defending himself. He just had like this weird quantum leap style flashback where all of a sudden it wasn't cops chasing him for robbing a liquor store. No, it was a armed band of vigilantes who were probably also chasing his relatives, his ancestors, for doing something fucked up. But no, let's put that aside. He had this generational genetic fear of white people being chased by white people with guns. And if we can get the jury to understand that, then they'll find him innocent. They'll understand, and if you understand the cultural context, that Native Americans, when they're getting chased by white people with guns, it just sends them back to like the 1850s, and they think that they're being chased by a bunch of white settlers. So that's what we need to get them to understand.
They would return a verdict of not guilty.
See, they'll return the non-guilty verdict if we can just explain this context to them.
Change of venue.
And that's also important. And this part's funny. All right. Change of venue. Now, what does that mean exactly? Well, you know, I've often talked about how there is a big problem with allowing non-whites to serve on juries, let alone be fucking judges. And that is, you are supposed to be judged by a jury of your peers. You're supposed to be, as a white man, you are supposed to be judged by a jury of your peers. And that's almost impossible now. It's nearly impossible. And I would say that the intent behind a jury of your peers was, it was supposed to be white juries, white male juries. That's what it's supposed to be. Women were not, in fact, at the time of the legal system being constructed in this country, women weren't even allowed to testify in court, let alone serve on fucking juries, okay? It should be white men and white, you know, on the juries, on the defense side, on the prosecution side, and as the judge. That should be who decides everything. And the second you don't have that is when things start to unravel. And they understood this. They understand that. They understand that, and that's why they wanted to change venues. Meaning that they want to try this case somewhere where there's not as many white people. Because they know if they try this case in a place where there's white people, and more specifically, in a place that has white people who interact with Indians on a regular basis and know how Indians are, that he will be found guilty in a heartbeat. Why? Because it's a pretty simple story. And they've heard it all. The white people who interact with Indians on a regular basis, they've heard the fucking sob story, the trail of tears, bullshit, whatever. And they're over it. They're fucking over it. Because they have to deal with drunken criminal Indians all the fucking time. And so they're fucking over it. And the Jew lawyer knows this. And so he knows it's extremely important to try to find a place he can have this trial that's going to have as few white jurors as possible. And he says as much.
From the basic understanding of the cultural background, we felt solid in our conviction that based on historic relations between Indians and whites in all rural Northern California counties, Mr. Croy's retrial had to be removed from Placer County.
White Indian relations. What does that mean exactly? Well, it means exactly what I said. It means that the white people in these counties have been dealing with drunken, murderous Indians now for fucking like over a century. And so they know exactly, they know that the jig is up. They know what they're like.
It was also clear that the all-white jury we would likely face in Placer County would have a difficult time objectively hearing our self-defense case.
Oh, yeah. In other words, white people would be onto our scam in a heartbeat.
Which would be based upon the contention that white police officers tried to kill Indians.
Oh, see, and that's literally going to be his argument. That, you know, the white police officers who are responding to a liquor store being held up, who are then shot at as they pursue the vehicle, leaving the scene of the crime, that the whole time it was actually just the murderous rage of the white police officers to blame for this situation.
We relied upon the traditional criteria for change of venue and emphasized the lurking danger of a prior conviction in a small community. But the thrust of our motion was the cultural defense. Our investigation showed that recent events in the last 20 to 30 years in Placer County placed the Indian community in a negative light.
I wonder why. So the behavior of the Indians for the past 20 to 30 years put Indians in a negative light. The white people having to live around the Indians didn't like living around the Indians. So it's insane because he's just saying it. I mean, he's saying it in a way that is trying to you know, pretty it up a little bit, but that's what he's saying. That's what he's saying. He's saying these white people are too experienced with Indians, so we can't have them on the jury.
And had inevitably contributed to the anti-Indian climate, which resulted in Croy's first conviction there.
Oh, yes. His first conviction for killing a cop with his gun was because of anti-Indian sentiment.
His mere presence, should he be retried there, would reactivate all the old anti-Indian stereotypes and biases.
Oh, yes. Can't have that either, right? Can't have his bad behavior reinforcing the stereotype that there's bad behavior from the Indians.
During the four-day evidentiary hearing, eight witnesses, six of whom were Indian people, testified regarding the history of Indian/white relations in California generally, and in Placer County specifically.
Oh, good thing that the hearing about whether or not you need to change venue because of all the racist white people included, out of the eight people that testified, six of them were Indians. So let's have all these Indians tell us their drunken side of the story.
We bolstered this contention with a survey interpreted by venue expert Professor Ed Bronson from Chico.
Oh, another Jew.
Another witness, local public defender Dave Humphrey, substantiated the danger in Indian defendant cases by relating a post-jury interview that revealed one juror in deliberation saying, "Well, this is exactly what happens when an Indian gets liquored up or has too much to drink."
Because it is exactly what happens when Indian gets liquored up and has too much to drink. That's 100% what happens. That's the point. That's not a racist thing to say. That's a honest thing to say.
It demonstrated the difficulty of uncovering anti-Indian bias in voir dire, despite specific questions which had been designed to unearth it. We contended that only in an urban environment with its diverse population, more tolerant views, and removal from the ongoing competition for local natural resources, could an Indian find a fair and impartial jury.
So only on a only a jury that's not white is what he's saying. The only way he can get a fair trial is if we pack the jury with non-whites. Or really what he's saying is the only way we can get a murderous, a cop-killing Indian acquitted is with a non-white jury. That's what he said it. He said that the only way that it would happen, the only way you'd acquit a cop-killing Indian is if you had a non-white jury. And he's right.
Judge Richard L. Gilbert, responding in part to the cultural defense testimony of our witnesses, ordered a change of venue, noting that the potential for residual bias against the defendant in the context of traditionally preconceived notions regarding Indian people raises a risk that prejudice will arise during the presentation of the evidence unrelated to the facts.
Oh, yeah, it's those racist white people. So they had to move it to a more urban area. I wonder how that worked out for them.
In these times of overburdened courts, it was not easy to find an alternative venue for trial. After a year of searching.
By the way, the overburdened courts, that was also a direct result of the changing demographics. The reason why those courts were overburdened was because a mix of the great Negro migration and tons of fucking Mexicans moving into California. That's why the courts were overburdened. It's because non-whites were committing lots of crime, and the system had been designed to deal with white people. And so when you have people who commit way more crime than white people, you suddenly have a system that's inadequate. It's unable to handle all the crime. Additionally, you used to not have Jewish lawyers defending all the fucking criminals. So the trials were a lot more efficient. People actually got a speedy trial and a speedy execution, even in California. But then you had this perfect storm of non-white people. You had brown people and black people coming in and committing a bunch of crime. And Jews defending them in court, like this fucker.
The only two counties that became available were Stanislaus and San Joaquin, both as unacceptable to the defense as Placer County.
Because too many white people.
In a two-day hearing, we demonstrated that racial bias against Indian people also existed there. An Indian woman from the local Indian education program testified regarding the contempt with which the entire community viewed the attempt of the Indian community to defend a legally protected Indian burial site.
Oh, yeah. in that case, then I guess white people can't be honest in a murder trial because they make fun of your Indian burial ground shit.
A local educator discussed minority voting rights suits against the local government. Professor Bronson analyzed the local media's anti-Indian bias and its...
Oh, even the media is anti-Indian.
...its effect upon that community. Pretrial motions. The cultural background of our client was raised in two pretrial motions. First, in a motion to strike the special circumstances in impermissibly charged due to the defendant's race, which was denied. Second, in a pretrial motion...
Wait, hold on. This, what was denied? What was that again?
In a motion to strike the special circumstances in impermissibly charged due to the defendant's race.
Does that mean they're trying to strike the charge because of his race? Well, at least they didn't do that.
Which was denied. Second, in a pretrial motion to admit evidence of the historical and contemporary Indian/white relations in the context of self-defense, which was granted.
Oh, if only it weren't granted. So they're allowed to present basically the sob story of the Indian people in the trial of this cop killer Indian.
Jury selection.
This one's important. Remember, he had to move venues just so he'd make sure to limit as many white people as possible. What did he end up with?
With the help of Karen Jo Koonin and Dina Logan at the National Jury Project, jury questionnaires and voir dire questions directed at...
See, that's the other thing, too. They have the National Jury Project. Jews have an organization dedicated to getting jurors, selecting jurors who are going to let off brown cop killers. Elon, where's your money going to something like that? Where's your money going to a organization that focuses only on jury selection when white people are arrested for some bullshit anti-white thing? Doesn't happen, does it? Doesn't exist. Nothing like that exists at all.
Directed at the issue of race were incorporated into the jury selection process. Of the 7 men and 5 women jurors who ultimately deliberated the case, 3 were black.
Oh, good. Off to a good start. So you got 3 blacks.
2 were Hispanic.
2 Mexicans already.
Two were Asian.
Great, Asians.
And 5 were white.
So you're going to lose now. You're going to lose. That's all they needed, right? They couldn't have 6 white people because then they could have a hung jury. Well, depending on how many of them were women, I guess. So they whittled it down to only 5 white people. Mission accomplished.
Guilt phase. The prosecution asserted 3 different theories to support its first-degree murder charge. That Mr. Croy conspired with others to kill police officers.
Well, I mean, he kind of did. He threatened to kill a cop with a group of his friends. in front of a bunch of people, lots of witnesses. Then, again, according to witnesses, he, after the cops left, got his gun and said, let's go to town and get ammunition because my wife won't let me have bullets on my gun. He then went to town and robbed a store and stole ammunition. He then shot at cops and killed a cop. I don't know. If that's not clear-cut conspiracy, I don't know what is.
That the killing occurred during the commission of a robbery.
Well, it did. that also is 100% supported by the evidence.
And that Mr. Croy committed premeditated and deliberated murder.
Again, he threatened to kill a cop in front of witnesses, said, I'm going to go get my gun, and by the end of the day had killed a cop. Pretty deliberate.
The defense to both the robbery and the conspiracy was that they did not occur.
Oh, you fucking Jew.
Mr. Croy admitted shooting the officer, but in self-defense, acting as a reasonable person would have acted under similar circumstances.
A reasonable non-white person, you see? You're very flexible with this word person, and that's the problem, is we have been too goddamn flexible with this word person. Let's stop pretending that they're people like us. Let's stop pretending that that word applies to everybody. Shall we? Can we stop pretending that when we say we the people, that includes non-white people? Do you think the founders, when they said we the people, meant like the people of Earth? We're talking about different subspecies, people. Let's just be honest here. We're not even the same species. We're really not. I want that to sink fucking in. We're not even the same fucking species. And that's not metaphorical. I mean, biologically, we are not the same.
The cultural evidence presented by the defense in the following areas contributed to the jury's acquittal on all counts.
Spoiler alert, he gets acquitted. Oh yeah, this works. What we're listening to, it worked. It worked on that jury with the three black guys, the Mexicans, and the chinks. It worked. It worked out.
One. Experts in anthropological linguistics and eyewitness identification were called to explain how the prosecution's non-Indian witness, who allegedly heard and identified certain defendants talk about shooting the sheriff, the basis for the conspiracy theory, could have misidentified, misunderstood, or misinterpreted the speakers.
You see, white people are just too stupid to know when an Indian says he's going to kill a cop. Don't you understand? You see, in our proud tribe, there's a word that sounds a lot like killing, I'm going to kill a cop, but it really means potato. You know, like, that's just, you know, if I want a potato, I go to my wife and say, I'm going to kill a cop. I'm going to kill a cop. Oh, you want to, I'm going to kill a cop. Yes, I'm going to kill a cop. Thank you for the I'm going to kill a cop salad. This is really delicious, honey. I really appreciate this. Oh, you know what? It would go good with this I'm going to kill a cop salad. How about I'm going to rape a bitch? Oh, yeah, here you are. Here's your I'm going to rape a bitch. Oh, that's pretty awesome. You know, it would really complete this meal is I'm going to get really fucking drunk and pass out on the side of the road and puke and shit myself for hours until they pick me up and throw me in the tank. Or as the white man calls it, Kool-Aid. If you could give me some of that Kool-Aid, that'd be great. That'd really, really round off this whole I'm going to kill a cop and I'm going to rape a bitch meal that you've prepared for me. I mean, that's what they're fucking saying. They brought in a linguist to say that a white person can't possibly understand, I'm going to kill a cop. You see, white people are just so fucking blind rage racist that they hear an Indian say he's going to kill a cop. And you gotta throw it out the window. He's not culturally in tune enough to know what an Indian is saying. That's impossible.
The defendants had been discussing shooting Pufich, going deer hunting.
Oh, of course. Of course. He wasn't gonna shoot the sheriff. He was gonna shoot some deer with his .22, by the way. You don't kill deer with a .22.
The experts verified that the Indian word for deer was Pufich and compared it phonetically with sheriff.
See, it sounds Pufich sounds just like sheriff, doesn't it? See, you can understand how you get it wrong. I mean, it's like that Bob Marley song, and every time I hear it, sometimes I mix it up. I always think he's saying, I shot the Pufich, but I did not shoot the I'm a rape a bitch. Yeah, it's like, come on, what the fuck? That's what they're doing. That's what they did.
Other areas of the linguist's testimony explained that Indian speech patterns differ from non-Indian speech.
Oh, speech patterns.
In addition, even if angry statements had been made by some of the Indian people, the linguist pointed out how anger and frustration felt by minority groups are vented by hostile language, which should not be interpreted as literal expressions of intent.
He's saying that non-whites are so out of control, they can't control their thoughts or their words. And so when non-whites get angry, sometimes they express themselves, they vent their frustration by threatening murder. And we have to understand that we have to, you know, be tolerant. We have to be tolerant of the non-whites who, when they get mad, they just threaten to kill you. That's just how they vent. He just vented.
He also discussed how the silence by Indian listeners to this hostile language should not be viewed as an acceptance or adoption of the sentiments, but to the contrary, signified disapproval and rejection by this particular community.
Oh, yeah, of course. And the fact that no one disagreed with him when he said he was going to kill he said he was going to kill a Pufich or something, right? So I don't know why it would matter that they disapproved.
The eyewitness expert, Elizabeth Loftus, emphasized the dangers of cross-cultural identifications made by the non-Indian witnesses.
See, this is the amount of money and resources that went into this, where they brought in all these people with lots of letters after their names, their Jewish last names, to come in and say, I'm an expert, I'm a professor at, you know, some Jew mindfuck organization. And I'm going to, you know, especially because the jury now is full of a bunch of 80 IQ retards that already hate white people. I'm going to give you now an intellectual basis for your desire to let a non-white off that killed a white cop. I'm going to just fill your mind full of gibberish that you wouldn't be able to understand even if it wasn't gibberish. So it's really indistinguishable. You can't tell the difference between just, you know, me rambling and saying big words that are meaningless or meaningful. You have no way of discerning which is which. And so you're just going to believe anything I say because I'm going to sound smart, and I'm therefore giving you a justification for your desire to allow a cop killer off.
Two, expert witnesses in the field of Indian history and contemporary affairs testified regarding the interactions between the Indian and non-Indian communities in Siskiyou County. This evidence was relevant to Mr. Croy's state of mind, that is, his good faith belief, whether reasonably or unreasonably held, that it was necessary to defend himself with lethal force.
It was They really did this. And it worked. They really did this. They brought in an expert that basically said that because of the past, because of the 1850s, that he had a good faith belief that shooting the cops that were pursuing him for holding up a liquor store, stealing ammunition from a liquor store after threatening to kill a cop, that he was the good guy. That from his cultural context, he was the good guy in that situation.
A large map of the area with numerous overlays illustrating the significant historical events, settlements, gold mining, massacre sites.
So they basically walked again. It was the white guilt. It was the white guilt for the white jurors, of whom there were only five. I'm not sure if we find out how many of those were women. But they have the white guilt attack on the five white jurors and the white hate attack on the non-white jurors, who are just like, yeah, those fucking whitey, man. They just fucking massacre everybody.
Was used in conjunction with the historian's testimony. A local Indian educator and an Indian administrator of local social services programs discussed the contemporary relationships between the Indian and non-Indian communities. Ed Bronson presented an analysis of the depiction of Indian people in the local media over an 8-year period.
Yeah, here's the thing. Over an 8-year period, you're probably going to have a lot of drunken Indians doing shit like what Croy did. That's going to be, that's what it's like, guys. I don't know if look, probably some of you guys out there, you've lived near an Indian reservation. I've spent many years living in close proximity to various tribes in different Indian reservations. And in fact, I was once a bouncer at a bar where people from Indian reservations would sometimes go and often have to be thrown out of. In fact, every time. I didn't even want to let them in. I wasn't allowed to not let them in, but I knew that at some point in the night, I was going to have to throw them out. And I did. 100% of the time. 100% of the time, when an Indian would show up to the bar, I was going to have to drag him out. But before the end of the night, I was going to be dragging his ass out and calling a cop over to arrest him. 100% of the time. And it's not just because I, worked at a bar. That was the case. In fact, that was two bars in two different states. Two bars in two different states where I was a bouncer. Exact same story. Both bordered had a reservation nearby. And these are different tribes. I think one was Navajo, one was Hopi. They're similar. I don't know. I can't tell the difference, honestly. They look the same to me. But anytime they came, you're like, all right, that guy's, he's going to be gone. If it was up to me, and it should be, if it was up to me, he wouldn't even come in. If we still had the freedom of association, he wouldn't be coming in. But we have to let him in, and now we have to kick him out because he's going to get drunk and like creep on some chick or start a fight with someone who's not even like talking to him, because no one talks to these people because they're fucking psychos. He's going to just go in there, with his dead-eyed fucking soulless stare, glare at the fucking bartender until it makes her uncomfortable enough to where she calls me over or something like that. He's going to pick a fight with some rando that's there with his wife. It's going to be something like that. It's going to be something. Or he's going to pass out in the bathroom or something. It's always fucking something. 100% of the time. And so I guarantee you, the local news reflected that.
In his opinion, Indian people received consistently negative and hostile coverage, particularly in their struggle for Indian rights.
Well, and that's the other thing, too. We're the only people to conquer another nation and then give them reservations to live on. That same courtesy will not be extended to white people. In fact, quite the opposite. This new non-white America that is emerging before our very eyes is very hostile to white people. And in fact, this is the case all across the West. You know, in fact, I was watching an interview with Thomas Sowell the other day, and he made a he should word this into something like piffy, because it's a good line. He was talking about how in Australia that all these non-white groups, because they cause problems, they get liaisons. They get special liaisons. And you see this in the UK. You see this in Australia. You see this in America, too. And that's because they're committing crimes. And so the law enforcement is creating a diplomatic, has a policy of diplomatic relations with these groups who are incapable of following the law and often create problems for the society, to try to mitigate these problems that they create by virtue of their presence there. And he made the comment that, you know, it's funny, all these groups, they have liaisons. And I think he was on with Tim Murdoch, and Tim Murdoch said, well, white people don't have a liaison. And Thomas Sowell said, well, yeah, we do. It's the FBI. It's the counterterrorism organization. It's, you know, it's MI6. And that really is the case. All these non-white groups who come in here and commit crimes and destroy our countries, they get liaisons, special liaisons, that, by the way, you're paying for. Your tax dollars are going into and paying for all these lovey-dovey liaison positions. And don't feel left out, because you have a liaison too. They're just there to lock you up when you complain about the other groups causing the problems. See, the problem with you isn't that you're actually creating any problems. The problem with you is you're noticing the problems they're creating. And that's fucked up. But it's true. And as this country becomes increasingly less white, that's precisely what you should expect.
The comic strip Tumbleweeds, which ran daily in the paper, exacerbated this image in its characterizations of Indian people as lazy, dishonest, violent, and sneaky.
They are, though. They're all those things. Now, Tumbleweeds, that's something I should have... Let's see if I can find a copy of this. Let's see how bad it is. Comic strip. Tumbleweeds. I can buy the book. I can't. How racist can it be? You can still buy it on fucking... I vaguely remember this. This is what they're complaining about? Oh my god. So this is what they're... I'm going to show you. Because I actually vaguely remember this. Let's see if I can find this in high enough res to show you. It's basically, let me put it this way. It's basically like saying Speedy Gonzales is proof that white people can't tell when a Mexican kills a cop, because Speedy Gonzales exists. Therefore, white people can't possibly be fair when it comes to a trial involving a Mexican cop killer. All right, so this is... I This is Tumbleweeds here. And again, look how the white guy doesn't exactly look like a genius either, okay? It's not like this is one-sided. So here's the cowboy says, "Now that your warrior buddies have left, I'll let you go your way and I'll go mine." And the Indian says, "You're a peach. During our brief association, I formed a sort of grudging admiration for you. May I have some small token to remember you by?" Wow, that's really making him look bad. The cowboy says, "Why, sure, pal. What you got in mind?" And the Indian says, "How about a lock of your hair?" Of course, it's a joke about being scalped. Wow, oh my God, it's so horrible, the humanity. How have Indians withstood this racial assault that is published in newspapers all around the country for decades? My Lord, this is the most racist shit I've ever seen in my life. So that's what he's talking about. That's what he's talking about.
3. The testimony of an Indian psychologist who had interviewed Mr. Croy over the years.
Oh, this should be good.
And finally, Mr. Croy himself provided the nexus between the foregoing cultural evidence and his state of mind that evening. Mr. Croy had himself grown up hearing stories of the genocide of his people.
Oh, that's what it is. That's what it was. It was because he heard stories. He heard stories, and so now he can murder cops because he heard stories.
He and his relatives had repeatedly been subjected to police harassment.
You mean police arrestment? How about that? It's police arrestment. When you get drunk in town and raise hell, you get arrested.
This evidence confirmed the defense contention that a reasonable person in Mr. Croy's situation would have responded in the same manner. He would have run from police when chased, even though he hadn't done anything wrong. He would have been afraid to surrender to the police once the shooting at the cabin area started. And he would have ultimately fired the fatal shot.
Yeah, that's what they argue. It worked, by the way, guys. They argued that anyone in that cultural context would have done, anyone, you, if that would have been you, you would have done that. You would have gotten fucking annihilated for 3 days straight. Or, well, I guess 2 days, 2.5 days, 2.5 days straight. And then threatened to kill the cops when they showed up because even your neighbors couldn't handle how loud you were being with 20 people over there getting annihilated all the weekend long. Even your wife thinks that you might actually kill a cop, so she takes the bullets out of your rifle. Because if you were just going to go shoot, like, Pushing or whatever the fuck the deer thing was, why would she take the bullets out of your rifle? No, she took the bullets out of your rifle because she knew you were going to go kill a cop. So you then take a rifle, and you don't have any money because you've just been blowing it all on fucking hashish and whiskey all weekend. So you go and rob a store that sells liquor and ammunition, and then you kill a cop. But, you know, anyone would have done that in his shoes. Anyone. You can understand that.
Special jury instructions were drafted, which incorporated the cultural evidence into or supplemented the CALJIC instructions on flight, self-defense, and homicide. The jury was thus able fully and fairly to apply the law to the facts. Application of the cultural.
So that was included in the jury instructions, where basically you have to take his cultural context into mind. Yeah, by the way, this is 1990. For those of you who want to go back to the 90s, I still see it. It's these delusional fucking millennials and Gen Xers that think that, like, the world was Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or something like that. This is what was going on in 1990. 1990, they were, this goblin Jew was using this defense.
application of the cultural defense to all minority defendant cases. No matter what the ethnic background of a minority defendant, the defense must begin with an examination of the cultural context of the individual. Although the specific examples cited in this article involve an Indian defendant, the overall approach applies to all minority clients.
All minority clients. So there's more to the document. They go on to talk about how they interviewed jurors afterwards, and they had jurors who, when they first heard the charges and the evidence, were like, well, how the fuck are they going to get this guy off? Why is he pleading not guilty? But after hearing the fucking sob story about the Trail of Tears and all this other fucking bullshit, they were like, oh, well, I guess, you know, in the context of his culture, it really makes sense why he would murder a cop. And he was found not guilty. He was found not guilty. Now, of course, they appealed this up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court upheld it. The Supreme Court at the time, and this is California Supreme Court, was this Jew right here, Justice Otto Klaus, a Jew from Germany. So a Jewish immigrant from Germany who came here after World War II. So one of the Jews that Hitler should have gassed showed up and started fucking up America immediately. Then you've got this Jew from Brooklyn, who also, his family, guess what? Came to America when? From where? From Eastern Europe, around the turn of the century. This Jew here, Justice Joseph Grodin. So again, not only is it you have to worry, and this is 1990, by the way, 1990. So not only do you have to worry about the jury not being a jury of your peers, but the justices. And by the way, that goes all the way to the Supreme Court now. Now the Supreme Court's not 9 white guys. It's not. And the Supreme Court of your state most likely is packed full of diversity and Jews at this point. So yeah, this Jew. Oh, and then you get this Mexican Catholic here. Justice Cruz Reynoso. Oh, isn't that great? Mexican Catholic here. Oh, and then an ugly white woman, Rose Byrd. All right, so we got two Jews, a Mexican Catholic, and a ugly white woman. Followed by a nigger. Justice Alan Broussard. And the white guys dissented. But they were outnumbered. The white guys were outnumbered. You see, the white guys were outnumbered, and you just now lost control of your Supreme Court of your state that was now being ruled by two Jews, a Mexican Catholic, an ugly white woman, and a nigger. So that was the beginning of the end. Well, that already started in California, but this was, you know, this was certainly a legal tipping point, you know, because they got rid of the death penalty. Yeah, you know, California used to put people to death all the time. Not so much these days. So they let him go. And his sister surprisingly remained in jail. They gave him 10 years probation. That was it. And in 1997, before his probation was up, he was sent back to prison. And I can't find really what it was about, but he went to prison for a couple of years. Probably some, you know, related to getting drunk and causing problems. And then let's see here. Oh, so then to get out of prison again, because it was basically violating his probation, right? So his probation meant he couldn't get in trouble and he couldn't, get hammered like all Indians do and cause trouble. And so to get rid of his probation so that he could go and just get drunk and cause problems and it would just be a misdemeanor, he wouldn't actually end up going to prison. His Jew lawyer then went in and asked them to actually remove all of his convictions. All of his convictions, so that he would not only would he not just be acquitted of the murder, because he had to plead. I think he had to plead guilty to something. It was like the robbery of the liquor store. It doesn't really matter. But he one of the lesser charges stuck. But they said time served when they let him out, right? And obviously he's off death row. He's out, but he has the 10 years of probation. So he breaks probation because he can't just fucking control himself. And another Jew, a Jew from Brooklyn, whose family came to America from Eastern Europe around the turn of the century, Lawrence K. Carlton, decided to just remove all of his convictions and give him a clean record so that he wouldn't have been. So retroactively, he wouldn't be in violation of any parole, or I'm sorry, of any probation, and so he could be released again. So they got him again, and they managed to get the cop killer back in on a technicality, just like they let him out on a technicality, and some other Jew swoops in and lets him back out. And now today, he lives in San Francisco. There he is. Look at him. Look at this fucking murdering. This is the cop killer. He lives in San Francisco and just gets high in the park and talks about Mother Nature all day long.
Expect all living things to be one with the Mother Earth and the Father Sky and live in harmony and not live in turmoil. And so growing up as a kid, I didn't see that, but older, I got that later on about through my dad.
And then I killed a cop and a Jew lawyer got me off so I can live off disability forever. Fuck you, Whitey.
So there you go. That is the story of Hootie Croy. That is the story of Hootie Croy. And by the way, thank you too. And I actually went to go look to see who it was. Did I accidentally delete it? I looked up who gave me the. I got it from a super chat, one of the recommendations. I'll find out what it is, actually. I got it written down somewhere. Let's see here. It was, I love being white. I love being white. That's a good name. I love being white. Recommended that as a topic. So that's the story of Hootie Croy. Anyway, let's take a look, I guess, at Super Chats, shall we? All right, first we got, obviously, over on Odyssey. We have the Love and Divisions still trying to make it a thing, trying to make the Odyssey chats a thing, which maybe someday they will be. Maybe someday they will be. I hope so, actually. Well, I don't know. I don't know. Odyssey needs to get their shit together on a few things. But anyway.
White power, white power, white power, white fucking power. White power, white power, white fucking power. White
All right. Love and Division says, hi, Devin. Caught Outlaws on replay. I really think you guys did a good job. Well, I appreciate that. I thought it went well. I was stressed about getting all the animations and everything done. And then we had some technical issues, but aside from the big one was we couldn't get YouTube to work with my restream we kind of waited last minute on that one and probably should have tested it and probably should, we still haven't tested it. Probably should get that straightened before Wednesday. But at the same time, it's YouTube. I don't especially like YouTube, but whatever. But other than that, I think it went off without a hitch. We got to find out about the hole in the roof, getting the hole in the roof, which I thought was kind of fun. Yeah. that was a nice story. We got to find out about the hole in the roof. Maybe in what we should do here is have a hole in a teepee, I guess. But yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Love and Division. And hopefully you'll be there next Wednesday. Because I'll be there next Wednesday. At noon, high noon, Pacific time. All right, then we got Optimistically Pessimistic says, hey, Devin, by the time, I do know there's missing ones. There's missing ones. Actually, you know what? Should I go look for those now? I'll tell you what. I'm going to go through these now, and then I'll go find the missing ones just because it's easier to do it that way. Optimistically Pessimistic says, hey, Devin, by the time you read this, I'll be at work being a good little goy so they can rape my check and send money to Israel. Well, and to people like this guy. So we can be blessed. I did see the blessing of gas prices jumping $1 a gallon over a 3-day period. Isn't that a great blessing? That is a good blessing, isn't it? Make someone some money. Then we got a Righteous Muffin. You guys want another clue? You guys want another clue? Maybe another clue. Canada. That's your only other clue. Canada. Righteous Muffin says, replay gang here. Good evening, Devin. I think the Outlaw stream was great. You and Rebecca have great banter. The stream was insightful and hilarious. I'm sure whoever you're talking about tonight needs to go into the roof hole. Thanks again for the great streams and have a good night. Well, appreciate that, Righteous Muffin. And, thank you, for the compliments and yeah, people need to check out Outlaws. It's the daytime show so that people who can't catch the live at night can catch a live in the daytime, right? It's slightly different. All right, then we got Adam Says Things. It says, in Canada, chugs are given lighter sentences due to what we call GLAUD factors, or GLADU factors. It's been enshrined in common law via case precedent. I'm going to look that up. What's GLADU factors? I'm sure it's this, right? It's this. Yeah. GLADU factors are systemic and background factors that courts must consider when sentencing Indigenous offenders in Canada. Yeah, it's this. That's what. And by the way, this is what you'll see. It's already what's happening. It's already how they treat Black people in the justice system, right? I mean, they, not explicitly, but that's already what's going on. But yeah, Canada has always been ahead of the game on this bullshit. But yeah. And we got Friendly Fash said, ever look into the Coconut Grove fire? Deadliest club fire in American history. 492 dead and the Jewish owner is the prime suspect. I feel like that's in my notes, but maybe it's not, so I'll copy it in there again. Let's see here. Where are the notes today? I have too many notepad files. I use a lot of notepad files these days. So I can keep secrets from the cloud. Actually, it doesn't even matter. Notepad, I think, uses the cloud now. Thanks, Microsoft. All right, let's see here. Thank you very much, Friendly Fash. I'll check that out. Are you a colonizer? Are you a colonizer?
White fucking power.
Are you a colonizer? Says, think of MAGA or patriot. A colonizer is loyal to whites. It is tribal. The action that I ask of you today is to use this label. So are you a colon? Oh, wait, you have it's backwards here. So I have to hold on. Let me start from the beginning here. You have said previously that Jewish superpower is that they believe they are chosen by God. Colonizers believe the same thing, but for white people, I want to clarify to you and your audience, the colonizer movement isn't simply about building space colonies, that it is the destiny. The belief is that whites were created to explore and build colonies. If you were to believe this and you are white, then you are a colonizer. Now I know that all of you are too cool for labels, but labels help you find others like you. If you want whites to be proud again, then they need a label to identify with that is easily defined and self-explanatory. Think of MAGA or patriot. A colonizer is loyal to whites. It is tribal. The action I ask of you is to use this label. Well, I would say this. I like the feeling behind it. I don't like the label simply because there are things about colonizing that epically backfired. And that is, I think that we should more so be conquerors. And it's kind of a mixed bag when it comes to colonizing. In some cases, you could say there was some conquering going on. And in some cases, you could say there was some lighting fuses that would later explode in the white people's faces, like in the case of India, you know, or in the case of South Africa, I guess. Like there's, I feel like it's. I get what you're saying, and I like the explorer aspect of it. And look, my ancestors were all colonizers. You know, they were colonists, maybe colonist, but then again, it has the same problems, right? I feel like if you're going to come up with a label, it should have, like, just from I'm just trying to think in like marketing wise, right? It should come with a hint of, if not explicitly conqueror, you know, it should have like an implicit sense of conquering. And I don't think, as much as you hear the left using colonizer as like, you know, as that is an implication, right? That it's these conquerors that go around. But even then, the reason why they say colonizer and not conqueror is conqueror sounds too badass. And colonizer sounds like something that they can spit on. And so I don't know that that's the best label. I like where your head's at with, in terms of, you know, white people are explorers and they do, that's what historically we've done. But I think there also needs to be some checks in place to prevent the mistakes of the past where we have gone to non-white areas and used our resources to try to educate and uplift the non-whites until they inevitably become a problem for us. And that would just be what I would want to avoid. And I don't know if there's like a different word for that. And I don't know if there's like a different, or if there's like a spin you can put on it. But like, that's the problem with it is you look at like, and I've done lots of streams on these, right? I've done lots of streams on these colonizers that came to, well, the Whitmans, right? Perfect example. The Whitmans, they were colonizing, you know, the Oregon Trail, and look how that worked out for them. And there's tons of stories like that, right? And there's not just with Americans when dealing with the prairie niggers. I mean, like just across the board, there have been problems every time white people have attempted to colonize with that strategy. And so maybe there needs to be something that it, at the very least is implicit that there's none of that going on, you know? Like there's none of that going on. Like I think conqueror is too strong of a word, and it sounds LARPy. And I think colonizer is too weak. And if there was something in between there. And then again, I don't know if there's like a label that would necessarily work. But maybe there is. But I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. It's just I think there needs to be that needs to be taken into account. Is that colonization was not necessarily always a good thing for us. But I like the spirit of, if it was colonizing uninhabited places like space, you know, that makes sense. But, you know, you get what I'm saying, I think. All right, then we got Minnesotan says, Devin, have you ever heard the story of John Coulter's run? He was a pioneer pioneer even sounds better, honestly. Pioneer sounds better because it doesn't imply that you are, I mean, it almost implies you're in it for yourself or at least for your family, right? You know, like it doesn't imply you're going to go there and then set up a colony and start teaching the Indians the Bible or something. You know what I mean? Like, Pioneers, I don't love it, but like that's a good example of, I think, a better word. Anyway, John Coulter, he was a pioneer who was attacked by the Blackfoot tribe and miraculously escaped them after they slaughtered his friends. Scary, interesting, talked about it on YouTube, but implied that Coulter made it all up, which is a retarded assertion. No, I've never heard of that. I'll maybe look into that. Yeah, there's lots of YouTube videos of leftists basically just saying, white people are bad. All these stories of white history where it shows minorities in a bad light, they're just made up by evil white people. Like the roof hole guy. You know? All right, then we got a Wandering Fool. Wandering Fool says, I think that an immediate focus for whites is to find as many pro-white boomers as soon as possible. They are few, but they are out there. The great boomer die-off is rapidly approaching, and there is a ton of money that could potentially go to pro-white causes if we can convince them not to give it to Global Homo. Then it says there should be a part. Oh, there it is. Okay, it was just a different color. We should be becoming bartenders at dying old men's clubs and letting them know we still exist. Hell, we can call ourselves colonizers. Don't argue with the drunks. Be a good person and proud of who you are. Word will spread. Look, there is something to be said about, and look, we give boomers a lot of shit, obviously, because to some degree they deserve it. But boomers are not worthless people at all. I mean, they have a lot of wisdom in ways that you might not think that they would. And there's a lot of value. And look, I interact with old people all the time just because of my interest in old radios. So I find myself discussing, you know, old radio stuff with people that were alive when my radios existed and were new. And, you know, you get to talking to them, and when politics comes up, if it comes up, you know, they're very boomery about it, but you know that it's all because they just don't get it. It's not because their heart's in the right place. If they got it, they would be on our side. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. And you know, that's just the way that it is. But it doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater. And by the way, not every boomer. There's some boomers. I've actually talked to boomers that are shockingly do get it. Like they exist. There are boomers that shockingly do get it. And so, you know, I think it's valuable to have at least a couple boomers that you interact with. Maybe not every day, but, you know, occasionally. If nothing else, it's good to get another perspective, even if you think it's retarded most of the time. It's not always retarded. And it doesn't always have to be political. You're right about just from a pragmatic point of view, trying to get your grubby hands on their money or trying to keep it in the family, so to speak, you know, try to keep it from going to like, say something, well, like this guy, the Indian guy. Yeah, I don't know how you would approach that subject. But I feel like inevitably just a lot of boomer money is going to go to brown people. It's going to go to a lot of brown, grandkids. I'll tell you that much. It's going to go to a lot of brown grandkids, and it's going to go to a lot of brown causes and a lot of Jewish causes. And I don't know, there's not really a way you can stop that, but I guess in your own personal sphere of influence, to the degree that you can influence these people to steer their money towards, you know, their wealth, their generational wealth, keep it in within the race as much as possible. I mean, that would be good, but I just think that's inevitably going to happen. And look, and some boomers are anti-white and will love it. They'll be happy to do it. But yeah, to the degree that you can, there are some boomers too. And, that don't have a family, that have lots of money. I know some of these people where they spend the $80,000 on a RV and they spend, you know, absurd amounts of money on just toys. On Corvettes. They're like 75 and they're buying a fucking Corvette like they're 21, you know, like and cruising around on, you know, in this fucking car. They never take over 65 miles an hour. And it's just, you know, they're just waiting to die, and they're just blowing their money before they die. But I think even those people, they do have on some level a desire for a legacy. And especially if they don't have any children or anything like that. It's a touchy subject, right? Especially with boomers. Boomers are really touchy when you start talking about money. They really like their money, you know. it's a hard, I feel like you would probably burn a lot of bridges with boomers. You start telling them what they should do with their money. But yeah, to the degree that you can, I guess, absolutely. All right, then we got Brian M. says, I volunteered at the Pine Ridge Reservation one weekend. Land was stunning. Most male Indians were so dead-eyed, mute animals, or blowhards. I was so alarmed, I decided to sleep outside, away, hidden in the middle of the prairie, hidden from view. Yeah, no, I'll tell you, I've had a lot of interactions with a lot, and I don't just, you know, aside from the you know, the drunks at the bar thing, just, you know, day to day and or at work or, you know, something like that. Those are the two types. There's the dead-eyed, drunk psychopath type. And then there's the one who thinks that they're fucking big shit because they're not the dead-eyed, psycho, drunk kind. And so they're really full of themselves because on the reservation, they're basically, you know, their IQ is maybe 90, but they're the only one around that's not drunk all day long, and their IQ is like 30 points above the rest of them. So on the reservation, they're basically Einstein. Well, let's not use Einstein anymore. But they're like a genius. They're like some kind of fucking magical genius. And then they talk to a white person of average intelligence who's automatically going to be smarter than them, but they don't get it. And they all have a chip on their shoulder. They all, like, low key, or sometimes not even that low key, hate white people. So they're very smug, and they bloviate about Indian shit all the time. And you're just like, God, shut up. No one cares about fucking Indian stuff. No one. Not even you. But yeah, I feel you. All right, then we got, are you a colonizer? Says, most boomers I talk to believe that the races are different. They are just afraid to say it. When I say I'm a racist, I'm not hateful. I just believe that races are different. Try this with someone you know, and you will witness something amazing. They all agree. It changes the entire conversation. It gets even better when you talk to them later, and they are calling themselves racist. It's like having you admit it gives them permission to admit it too. Yeah, to some degree you're right, and that's for some boomers, but yeah, it all depends on who you're. People are going to have to just judge for themselves the people that they have in their sphere, the people that they can try to race pill. But yeah, if you know, without being predatory, obviously, you don't want to be like, some vulture circling over the boomer waiting for him to kick off so you can take his boomer bucks. But yeah, I think it's good to plant the seed in their minds that, hey, leaving a legacy, it does not mean giving your money to some fucking Jewish cause. Then we got Vitget. Vitget. Oh, we just did that one. All right, Vitget says, hello, Mr. Stack. You must be mistaken because I watched Outlaws live on YouTube last Wednesday. Really? Okay, well, I'll have to ask Rebecca about that. Even submitted $20 super chat and it went through. Check Rebecca's YouTube channel. It's still on there. You know what though? It might not have been live. It might have been a premiere because I think she uploaded the recording and then played it as a premiere. And so that would have a chat. So I don't know if that's what you saw and you thought it was live. I don't think it was live. Well, the weird thing was is she gave me the stream. Well, I don't want to get into it, but we'll have it working on Wednesday. We'll have it working on Wednesday. I've never streamed to YouTube. I don't think. I mean, and if I did, maybe I did like a million years ago. I don't even know if I have. I don't know if I was streaming back when I was still on YouTube ever. But anyway, we'll get it strained out. We'll get it worked out. But thank you very much, Vitget, for the generous dono there. Then we got Adam Says Things. Says the word you're looking for is civilized. I don't remember you're probably right. Then remind.me says donation. Well, I appreciate that. All right. Then we're going to go to the old ones. Because I think there are some old ones hiding. I've been told there are some old ones hiding. Okay. Let's see here. So it wouldn't be Wednesday. So Wednesday was the 4th. So it'd have to be between One, two, and three is what I'm looking for. So those are all the fourth. Those are all the fourth. Well, I don't know. Maybe I don't have one. I think Gorilla Hand said that I had some hiding, and I don't see them. Unless he means even before that. Let me go back even further. But Gorilla Hands, I'm not seeing... I went back to the 28th, Gorilla Hands. Which would have been Saturday. Let me go before that. It's not letting me because it's the prior month. Is there a way to do it? I gotta have the call with Entropy, so I don't have to fucking deal with this nonsense every time. It's not nonsense. I get it, but it's, you know what I mean. It's like everyone has to wait while I'm like clicking around aimlessly in this thing. Is there a way to do it by month? Oh, yeah, there is. Okay, February. No, hold on. I can't. Sorry, Gorilla Hands. I can't. As far as I can go back is the 28th. And I don't see any from you that I didn't read. Yeah, sorry, Gorilla Hands. It doesn't let me on the list where I can look at old chats. It doesn't let me go back that far. If I switch to February, it doesn't change. Well, maybe it does, actually. I might have just figured it out. Oh, I might have just figured it out, Gorilla Hands. Hold on. Yeah, but I still don't see any. I'll even sort it by you. I like how it just... All right, hang on. Yeah, sorry, Gorilla Hands. I'm sorting it by just... I'm looking at just yours. And I don't see one from the time period you were talking about. But, look, I'll double-check after the show and... You know, I can, because there looks like there's a way I can search by amounts and stuff. I'll look for like big ones and, you know, see what, because you said it was like a big one. But we'll do that. I'll do that after the show. Sorry. I wish I could do it more easily. And hopefully in the future, I will be able to do it more easily. After I have the chat with the Odyssey people. All right, then we got Zazzy McTazbot that says, thanks for your work. Very excited for your new show. Well, I appreciate that. Then we got Real Starfish Prime says, test shekels before the stream. If received, thank you for doing an early edition on Wednesday for East Coasters that work early. I think you and Blonde will be a great team. Well, I appreciate that. And, see, that's why we do it. That's why we do it. All right, then we got Sarah Town says, hi, Devin, looking forward to listening tomorrow, and I went to school in England, so I'm not who you are thinking of. Well, that's good, because it's good. Just trust me on that. All right, then we got Real Starfish Prime says, test shekels before the stream. All right, that's a repeat. Then we got... can never, I've never pronounced this out loud, but it's, I think it's Duguay. Sarah says, congrats on Outlaws. Well, I appreciate that. And then we got, Yo Jimbo Rockford. See, I'm not calling you Jim Bob anymore. Says, congratulations on a successful first Outlaw episode. I put the over-under at 5 episodes before Blonde's YouTube channel gets nuked for all the no-no words. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I don't know how necessary YouTube is. We both, it's such a shame because we both have like a lot of subscribers. Even I still have like a billion subscribers over there. And so many people have no idea that I still, it's insane. But like a lot of these people are just stuck on one platform and never go off. They're not going to go, you know, to Odyssey or go to Rumble or whatever. So, I mean, I get going on this platform just because that's, you know, people are lazy. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. And look, it's a daytime show. See, it's not the Insomnia Stream. It's a daytime show. Not that we'll be, you know, we're not going to be pro-white, but we might be slightly less edgy in a daytime show than a late night show. I don't know. Not content-wise, like we were talking about the roof hole. We'll be about that edgy. I think that was, yeah. But maybe you're right. Maybe we will get nuked. Let's see here. We got, Yo Jimbo Rockford again says, here's some more shekels. I think your Engine Mythbuster episodes are some of the best streams. These TP Jews are almost as bad as gypsies. I don't know if you have dealt with them. Oh, I've dealt with them. But I believe that every, oh, not gypsies, I haven't. But I believe that every gypsy man, woman, and child is the kind of folks that make the world better by not being in it. Not a good one in the lot. I bet you could find some very interesting gypsy material. If we had gypsies, and I think we have some. If we had, like, I've never lived anywhere where there's gypsies. I think there has to be, because, you know, I feel like there's kind of gypsies everywhere. And I think the East Coast has gypsies, maybe. But I've never interacted with a gypsy. But I hear universally bad things about them. So I get it. And by the way, just like with Jews, it's like cross culture, all negative. Every country they live in, negative. Like there's no place where like, oh, those are the good gypsies. No one ever says that. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I'd have to find some local stories of them. Good Reason says stereotype, etymology, C. Lippmann, C. Post World War I, Board of Inquiry, no surprises. So basically what you're saying is the same Jews that came up with the word genocide also came up with the word stereotype. Why am I not surprised? Why am I not surprised? The fact that Jews have invented the language necessary to mindfuck us. I mean, look, it's kind of impressive. It's a little impressive that they were able to introduce new words that didn't even exist in our language and then push them to push their ideas that didn't exist in our brains. It literally is. It's like writing little viruses. It's writing little viruses, little mind viruses. Then we got Migma or Mig something, Migmate says, did you see here the Iranian number station that went up after the assassination? There was also some new bizarre Russian FSK along with some Israeli jammers. They even did some Jew Star Spectrum art. No, I haven't really been keeping up with that. I've been doing some other stuff. Haven't been on the radio much, the last little bit. But that's interesting. I might have to check that out. Yeah, number stations are always cool. And it does make you wonder. I mean, it's the perfect way to do it. Because if you have, it's undetectable, right? Like you can have a shortwave receiver in your home and no one's going to know. So if you were just as an example, if you were like a Iranian spy sleeper cell somewhere in the world, it's the perfect way to send you a message without anyone knowing that you got it. So, yeah. All right, then we got Blackout King says, Curtis Yarvin reminds me of Andy Dick. Well, and from what I hear, in more ways than one. For they're both pretty degenerate. Didn't Andy Dick die or something recently? Or like almost die? Is he dead? Let me look. I mean, I know he's like, if he's not dead, he's basically homeless at this point, right? He has not died yet. Because 12 hours ago, there's a story about him getting brain damage. Okay, well, there you go. There you go. All right, we got, let's see here. Purple Cat Mint says, thanks, Devin. Great stream tonight. Appreciate that. Scroll, scroll, scroll. Then we got the Shogun says, the voice connection between you and Rebecca is uber quick. Little to no delay. That's usually never the case when it comes to streaming from such distances. That's good for not cutting each other off. Oh, yes, I'm using technology that doesn't require a intermediate server. It's point to point. So it should be extremely low lag and higher quality as a result. So I'm surprised you noticed that actually. But that was very important to me, is that we have that really quick connection so that, yeah, it wouldn't be like, be weird all the time. So, oh, I'm glad that, that came across. It was worth all the headaches that to get that working. All right. Hopefully it works on Wednesday. All right, let's see here. Then we got Dauntless Dissident NZ says, gypsies are the descendants of Indians from the subcontinent that migrated to Europe centuries ago. They're mulattoes with all the fine traits of Jeets. Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Well, there you go. All right, guys, let me just double check back on entropy. We got one more from VitGet that says, P.S., it warmed my heart to hear you say nigger on YouTube. Thanks for all that you do. Well, that's because I didn't think we were on YouTube. So, yeah. We'll probably have to bleep those out. Maybe I'll get a bleep button or something and I'll bleep us. Too bad we can't just bleep just on YouTube. That would be awesome. That would be awesome if there was just like some auto sensor feature, some AI like auto sensor feature that would just replace it with like Niglet or Niggler. That would be awesome. All right, guys, I think that's everything. Let's double check here. All right, well, hopefully you guys have a good rest of your weekend. And again, like I said, we'll see you on Wednesday at high noon for another episode of Outlaws with Rebecca Hargraves and Devin Stack. And then again, of course, on Saturday, same bat time, same bat channel, the Insomnia Stream. In the meantime, I am, of course, Devin Stack.